Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It was 40 years ago today that began the War of 6 Days, the famous Six-Day War that changed the landscape in the Middle East. It's impossible now to imagine what the map of the Middle East would look like without what happened 40 years ago. We're going to be talking today about what happened over the 6 days that began 40 years ago today and why that matters. We're going to be talking about the nation of Israel. We're going to be talking about the geopolitical realities of the world 40 years ago. We're going to be talking about what it means today. We're going to have a very special guest, Ralph Peters, an expert on the war and on the situation in the Middle East. This is going to be a fascinating discussion. You're going to hear a lot in coming days about the Six-Day War, but this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We're going to be talking about what this means as Christians try to think about the shape of the Middle East, the challenge of the Israeli-Palestinian problem, the relation between Israel's status as a nation and Arab ambitions. We're going to be talking about all of this together today on the Albert Mohler Program, a discussion about Israel 40 years after the Six-Day War. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There's a lot of talk right now about what's going on in the world, and one of the things that is going on in the world is that kids are staying indoors. I wrote an article at albertmohler.com, posted it overnight. It's entitled Avoiding Nature Deficit Disorder. It's about theology, not therapy. A couple of years ago, an author by the name of Richard Louv wrote a book entitled Last Child in the Woods. I wrote a review of it. You go to my website and find my article posted last night. You can also find a link directly to my review of his book. Fascinating author, kind of a man on the environmental left, but he had something really, really good to say about how children today are growing up without any real contact with nature. They're playing Nintendo. They're watching television. They're on the internet, but they're not outdoors. Some parents are even afraid to let their kids go outdoors. It is shocking to find out how much time kids spend inside rather than outdoors, and especially in the summertime. I mean, that's the time when kids are supposed to have free time. That's when you should kick them outside and tell them to go just have fun. God has given us an incredible creation. Now, this whole idea of nature deficit disorder is just another reminder that Americans will turn anything into a therapeutic category. We'll turn anything into a psychological syndrome that needs some kind of therapeutic solution. Well, here's the solution. Take the kid outside. Let him watch tadpoles in the creek. You know, take your kids to see a sunset in the mountains. Just take them outside and look at green grass. Look at one of my favorite things to see, which is a spider web covered with dew. You know, just understand the wonder of creation. Help them to understand what the rings on the tree mean. Let them hear the birds. I mean, it's just the whole thing. And it's a shame when kids encounter nature like that, and it's all as if they've just visited a zoo. They've never seen or heard these things before. The Guardian in Great Britain, one of London's major newspapers, has an article by Stephen Moss that was published overnight on the fact that British children are experiencing the same alienation from nature. This is what he had to say. Nowadays, not only has children's time become more pressured, but they're also expected to use it constructively. Every pastime must have a purpose. But if everything in a child's life is organized, interactive, and based on supervised experiences, then there isn't much time left for spontaneous, unmediated activities. And that includes outdoors. Now, the point I make in my article, and we're going to come back to this to discuss it on this program at a later date. The point I make is that for Christians, this is about theology, not just therapy. It's not really just about having kids connect with nature. It's about having kids understand what a great God we serve and worship, who's given us such a world as this. We have to turn the natural question into the supernatural question. And for us, having kids alienated from nature is not just something that we should worry about for its environmental consequences and psychological consequences, but rather for its theological consequences. They fail to understand what the psalmist understood when he said that the heavens declare the glory of God. Three of the major Democratic candidates were in Washington, D.C. yesterday discussing their faith and how it impacts politics. What we encounter in the exchange yesterday, sponsored by Sojourners Magazine, is the Democrats trying to to position themselves as, quote, people of faith. I am not very attracted to that category, as if faith is something that exists without an object. But nonetheless, it was a fascinating discussion. And one candidate in particular, former Senator John Edwards, got right to the heart of the issue. We're going to listen to what he had to say in three separate clips, and we're going to talk about what this means. Let's just roll what he had to say.
Do you think homosexuals have the right to be married?
No. Not personally. Now, you're asking about me personally. But I think there's a difference between my belief system and what the responsibilities of the President of the United States are. It is the reason we have separation of church and state. And they're very good people, including some people that I'm very close to. My daughter, who's sitting on the front row here tonight, feels very differently about this issue. And I have huge respect for those who have a different view about this. So I think we have to be very careful about ensuring that the President of the United States is not using his belief system and imposing that belief system on the rest of the country. I think what that means in this case is the substantive rights that go with partnership, civil unions, for example, and all the substantive rights that go with that should be recognized in this country, at least in my judgment, should be recognized. And I think it is not the role of the federal government to tell either faith-based institutions, churches, synagogues, what they should or should not recognize.
Now, what you have there is a massive confusion, but basically you have a candidate trying to say, I'm opposed to homosexual marriage personally. He gives no extended reason why not, but then he says, but I'm not going to impose my personal morality on the country. I'm going to separate the role as president, if I'm elected, from those personal convictions. He also is falling all over himself, saying, I hold this conviction, but I have equal respect for people who hold the opposite conviction. And then, as if that's not bad enough, you got to listen to what Soledad O'Brien asked him, following up on that, and listen to this response. There's so much here that really ought to have our attention.
If you think something is morally wrong, though, you morally disagree with it, as President of the United States, don't you have a duty to go with your moral belief?
No, I think that, first of all, my faith, my belief in Christ plays an enormous role in the way I view the world. But I think I also understand the distinction between my job as President of the United States, my responsibility to be respectful of and to embrace all faith beliefs in this country, because we have many faith beliefs in America.
If that is a serious response, we should be scared to death. I mean, that is one of the least sensical responses to an intelligent question I've heard in a very long time. And frankly, it could come from some Republicans as fast as from this Democrat. There is nonpartisan, or I should say mutually partisan, confusion among many people on these issues. Let's just take this position taken by Senator Edwards to its logical conclusion. Soledad O'Brien asks, if you think something is morally wrong, though you morally disagree with it, as President of the United States, don't you have a duty to go with your moral belief? And Senator Edwards says no. He says, I understand the distinction between my job as President of the United States, and then he goes on and says to be respectful and to embrace all faith beliefs in this country, etc. Well, let's just say that he is answering that as a matter of principle. He's trying to pose a moral principle here. But the background to this is the question of homosexual marriage. And he just makes an emphatic statement saying that it is not a president's role to impose his moral beliefs. Well, what in the world do you do with Abraham Lincoln? What do you do with the issue of slavery? If Abraham Lincoln had held to that position, there would have been no Emancipation Proclamation. And there would have been no end to slavery. That was a moral issue. That was a president imposing his moral view. There would be no Franklin Delano Roosevelt with his Declaration of Four Freedoms, these four moral principles that he said he was willing to put the country's reputation on the line for. He was willing to send soldiers on the line for. I mean, what about World War II? I mean, what in the world do you do with that? That was a president in making a moral distinction between good and evil and saying we've got to go with the good and defend it. We've got to eradicate the evil. This idea that you can all of a sudden say, I have a faith perspective over here, and it means that I'm opposed to homosexual marriage, although I don't hold that position strongly enough that I would either try to apply it to a public policy, nor do I believe in it strongly enough to say that I think people who hold the opposite position are wrong. You have the effort to try to pose as holding a position of moral conviction, but when it comes right down to it, it's not a position of moral conviction, and Soledad O'Brien saw that during the interview yesterday. Here's where the thinking process for intelligent Christians needs to kick in. If it really is a moral issue, you can't take it with moral seriousness without seeking to take moral responsibility for it in public office. That doesn't mean that every single issue is treated with the same level of importance. But when you categorically say you're not going to let your moral impulses and your moral convictions guide your leadership, that is a recipe for absolute moral disaster. We're going to be listening for this as the campaign rolls on. Back with your call in just a moment. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Looking back over the last 50 years, there were several events that took place without which you can't understand the world today. One of those began 40 years ago today. It's what's now known as the Six-Day War. It reshaped the entire Middle East, and behind it is a tremendous story of great historical consequence and also a lot of contemporary interest. My special guest today is Ralph Peters, writer, strategist, commentator, retired military author, officer. He's the author of 21 books. The 22nd is soon to come out, entitled Wars of Blood and Faith, Conflicts That Will Shape the 21st Century. That's coming out in August. Ralph Peters, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Hey, great to speak to you.
I really appreciate you coming on because we need a new generation. Many people listening to this program weren't alive in 1967. We need to go back and ask the question, what happened and why does it matter? First, the what happened. Tell what is the key center to the story of the Six-Day War?
Well, the center of the Six-Day War is simply this. 19 years after Israel's desperate struggle to found a nation in the Middle East, a homeland for the Jewish people, 19 years later, the Arab countries surrounding Israel on three sides moved their armies to Israel's borders, led by Egypt, which moved over 100,000 troops, thousands upon thousands of combat vehicles, to within 1 hour's drive of Tel Aviv. The Arab media, the airwaves were full of genocidal hatred. They were going to destroy Israel, kill the Jews, and drive any survivors into the sea. Israel, this tiny country, did everything it could to avoid going to war. It was the Israeli forces were badly outnumbered, still equipped with cast-off World War II equipment. They did all they could, but Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran. Egypt readied itself for an invasion, and at the last minute, when they had no choice, the Israelis struck. And their dedication, their will to survive, their courage and their skill literally performed miracles. In the first waves of attacking aircraft, they destroyed 80% of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. Their troops outnumbered, plunged, it's almost biblical, plunged into the midst of the Egyptian forces, and despite some tough fighting, routed them. Now, all the while, the Israelis were trying their best to keep Syria and Jordan out of the war. They didn't want to fight. But even as on the first day and into the second day, the Israelis are just tearing through the Egyptians and giving them the defeat they literally deserved for wanting to destroy and exterminate Israel. This was the age before 24/7, before satellite coverage for everybody. And Radio Cairo and Egypt's diplomatic missions kept telling everybody in the world that Egypt was winning. Nasser announced that his army was approaching on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, and what happened was, well, the Syrians thought, well, we want to be in on this, so they start shelling from the Golan Heights. They're shelling the kibbutzes in northern Galilee. King Hussein, Jordan, of course, is the weakest member, but the most professional military of a small one, but he was forced to put his troops under Egyptian command, and the Egyptian generals turned out to be incompetent, and so Jordan attacks Israel. Syria attacks Israel. Israel's engaged in a war with Egypt. And again, I cannot stress how badly tiny Israel is outnumbered. But with absolute, phenomenal courage, Israel just charged into the fight, stormed up the steep slopes of the Golan Heights, and I've been there, and it's a brutal country to fight in. And they just kept going up and kept fighting their way to the top. They didn't want to take the Golan Heights. They didn't want to take Jerusalem. They didn't want war. But they found the Jordanians shelling, destroying hundreds, then thousands, destroying hundreds of Israeli buildings with artillery fire, damaging thousands, killing Israelis. So the Israelis called in the paratroopers, launched an attack. It was tough fighting in Jerusalem. But for the first time in 2,000 years, we saw Jews enabled to pray at the Western Wall. And I will tell you that the injustice done, that the Arabs tried to do to the Jews, to me, seems to have been punished in an almost cosmic sense. And I don't want to drone on about this, but in 6 days, Israel defeated all its enemies and, against its will, wound up in possession of the Golan Heights, the West Bank, Jerusalem, Gaza Strip, and Sinai. It was one of the most lopsided victories in military history.
You know, I think, again, thinking of so many people who are alive today who weren't alive then or weren't aware of what was going on, certainly a new generation, I think many of them take Israel for granted now without understanding that less than 20 years after its establishment and recognition by United Nations action, the Arab nations around Israel were still absolutely committed. And we're not talking about just about Iraq and Iran here. We're talking about Syria and Egypt in particular. They were absolutely committed to the eradication of Israel.
The eradication of Israel and the extermination of Jews. And we can't forget that part either, because even today, while I don't approve of everything Israel does, I always come back to the fundamental difference between Israel and its enemies. Israel wants to live in peace. It is a rule of law democracy that wants to live in peace with its neighbors. Among its neighbors, core elements still want to see Israel destroyed.
Now, when you talk about Israel, another misconception, I think, of many people today is that Israel has always been what it is now. And when you traced the war, the 6 days of war from 1967, you talked about Israel regaining the Gaza Strip, or gaining, I shouldn't say regaining, but gaining the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. Now, describe Israel's defensive predicament before the Six-Day War.
Well, before the Six-Day War, in Israel's narrow waist, it was literally an artillery shot from the West Bank to the sea. Israel could easily have been cut in two.
Now, having been there, that makes perfect sense to me. I've been to the Golan Heights. I've been to the West Bank. I've been in that area. And one of the things that Americans, especially being a continental nation, we can't imagine is the very small space we're talking about here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And when I went to cover the war last year, you know, I got off the plane Tel Aviv at Ben-Gurion Airport, and within 2 hours, I was all the way up north and at the front. I mean, it's a two-hour drive to the northern border. To the southern border, where the Israelis faced the Egyptians in 1967, it was literally a one-hour drive from Tel Aviv. And so the lack of strategic depth, to use the military terms, was a terrible vulnerability. In 1967, Israel literally could not let the Egyptians shoot first, because once the Egyptian army, that huge behemoth, got going, it would have rolled over the Israelis.
Ralph Peters is my guest. He's going to stay with us when we come back to talk about the meaning of the Six-Day War and how it reshaped the world as we know it today, and frankly, how we should be informed by that knowledge to understand many of the most important strategic controversies in the world today, especially dealing with the Middle East. I am really struck by the fact that so many Americans now have no knowledge of what happened in those 6 days and how it reshaped the world, and frankly, why the position of Israel now is really defined by the experience they had so early in their own national history. To join this conversation, maybe there's a question you want to ask Ralph Peters about this war. The opportunity is now to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Back with your calls. I'm Albert Mohler.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. The war lasted 6 days but completely reshaped the map of the Middle East. For one thing, by the time the war was over, Israel controlled the territory extending all the way into the Sinai Peninsula. Geopolitically, lots of changes. The war got the attention of both the United States and the Soviet Union, leading to even implications for the Cold War. The corruption of the Nasser regime in Egypt was laid bare by what my guest today, Ralph Peters, reminded us of earlier, and that is the lies that the Nasser regime had been broadcasting to the world and its own people about their victory that turned out to be a humiliating defeat. Ralph Peters is a specialist, retired military officer, frequent commentator in the media on matters of the military, and author of now 22 books on military subjects. Ralph, let me ask you, when you think about the war, just look at the year 2007. I have before me a flurry of articles, and some of them are making the serious argument that Israel should have given it all back as soon as it was over. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, Israel wanted to give it back, but Israel wanted peace. And a problem that Israel faced was that Egypt, even now, doesn't want the Gaza Strip. I mean, the Gaza Strip is a zoo. Egypt wanted the Sinai back, but not Gaza. And, you know, Egypt did eventually come to the peace table. And we do have a peace, however reluctant on the Egyptian side, between Cairo and Tel Aviv. The Syrians have just been adamant they don't want peace because the Assad regime, whether father or son, is afraid that if they lost the excuse of Israel being at fault for everything, the regime couldn't last. I mean, regimes like the Assad regime need an enemy. Now, as for Jordan, which lost almost half its territory and population, the West Bank, the fact is that Jordan and the Hashemite kingdom has probably only survived because it lost the West Bank. Jordan doesn't want the West Bank back because then Palestinians would overwhelmingly outnumber the Bedouins who form the core of the old Jordanian population.
Yeah.
So it's just much more complex than the instant critics
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that perplexes me is when people act like the Arab nations have been the friends to the Palestinians, and then that's simply not the case at all. As a matter of fact, King Hussein of Jordan declared war on the PLO.
Yeah, and the PLO declared war on him as well. But, no, you've hit one of my hot buttons. You know, for all this nonsense about how we support the Palestinians, the truth is that the Arab world abandoned the Palestinians. With all the oil wealth that's flowed into Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, couldn't they have done something for the Palestinians? Why are the Palestinians still living in squalor in Gaza, the West Bank, and in Lebanon? Why are they dispersed around the world? Israel actually has tried to work toward a Palestinian homeland in the West Bank and Gaza, and look what happened when they turned Gaza over. It just degenerated into Mad Max, on steroids, if you will.
Yeah.
It's really sad, but I do feel for the Palestinians.
Well, you have to.
Not because of what Israel's done to them, but because what their Arab brothers have done to them.
Absolutely. Let's go to Earl calling from Hayes, Kansas, looking on the XM-170. Go ahead, Earl.
Yes, I was just taken aback by the fact that undoubtedly there was a very high population of the Israeli populace involved in the 67 war, and how we as Americans, when we have such a much smaller percentage of our people directly involved in the Iraq conflict, for instance, don't seem to have the stomach pursuing the right end and result.
Yeah, Earl, you know, the last time that I was in Israel, I was there during the Madrid peace talks, and one of the interesting things is that even at that time, you could be standing where Arab forces had been shelling during the Six-Day War. You couldn't get away from this war in Israel. Ralph Peters, how do you respond to that?
Well, Earl raises some very good points. First of all, he's absolutely right. Less than 1% of the American population is bearing the burden of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the overall war with terror. So that's absolutely true. And it's unfortunate because, you know, in World War II, FDR, he was smart. He knew we didn't need spotters for German aircraft in upstate New York, but he had them. He recruited people because he wanted all Americans to have a stake in the war. Today, Americans don't feel a stake in Iraq.
We'll be right back to continue this discussion. Call in with your question at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The world changed 40 years ago, starting today in 6 days of war. This is the place for intelligent conversation about why it matters. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Ralph Peters, well-known commentator on issues related to the military, a retired military officer, and the author of 22 books and several hundred articles on matters military, one who is very familiar with the meaning of the Six-Day War, which is the topic of our conversation today. Ralph Peters, let me ask you a question. There's a new book out by Tom Sigev of the newspaper Haaretz, and he's arguing in his book, 1967, Israel, the War in the Year That Transformed the Middle East, that Israel never should have fought this war. You know, I find that an almost incredible assertion. What's going on there?
Well, you know, Israel is a country like our own that has freedom of speech, has diverse political views, and some of those political views get pretty nutty. And, of course, there's always a tendency to sensationalize when you're trying to sell a book.
Let me get to one core issue here, just to set you up for a response I think our folks can understand. You mentioned that Nasser himself had over 100,000 Egyptian troops massed on the border with Israel. Mr. Segev says that Israel looked at that and got paranoid. How can you not get paranoid? I don't think it is paranoid when you're looking at 100,000 troops massed on your border, is it?
Yeah, but, you know, we have people in our own country that say that terrorists aren't really a threat, that America is the real threat to the world. And, you know, if we just didn't respond, terrorists would go away. There's always going to be crazies. But looking at it objectively, with 40 years to cool our tempers, it is absolutely clear and agreed on by historians and analysts that Egypt fully intended to attack and destroy Israel. Egypt didn't move 100,000 troops and thousands of combat vehicles to Israel's immediate border just to parade up and down. There is no question about it. Egypt was going to attack. Israel had no choice but to fight.
Mr. Peters, I want to ask you another question. Let's assume for a moment that the Israeli government in 2007 hires you as its strategic analyst. What would you say to Israel now about how it should handle some of the territory that it gained in the 1967 war? Would you say give it back? Or, you know, what would you say now?
Well, the important thing Israel has to do is recognize that there's a crucial difference between strategic terrain, you know, strategic ground, and territory that has an emotional appeal. There are areas in the West Bank that Jews would like to have for religious and historical reasons, but there are conflicting claims. You know, no people can have everything. What Israel has to do is concentrate on areas such as the Golan Heights that it can't afford to give back, because it would open the door for a military attack and disaster. So that's the crucial issue, is what can Israel afford to give back? Because it will, unfortunately, have to give some things back. Also, Israel needs to keep working with the more rational elements within the Palestinian government, such as it is, because it has no choice. That said, we all need to be realistic and recognize the fact that there is not going to be a perfect peace in the Middle East, nor even an enduring peace between Israel and its neighbors, because the people on the other side of the border, across from Israel, the hardcore demagogues and really good haters and the Islamist fanatics, just can't give up Israel as an enemy. Israel is a great boogeyman. So Israel wants peace, but its enemies don't. And so we will not see enduring peace. What can Israel hope for? Survival, muddling through, to continue to build a successful economy, a rule of law society. I mean, I love going to Israel. It's like here. These are wonderful people who are just struggling to survive and make better lives for themselves. And by the way, we shall remember that the Arabs who live in Israel are the most prosperous of the Arabs in any neighboring country. You go there and you drive through places such as Nazareth, and the new construction of Muslim Arab homes, these huge mansions, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that with my own eyes. Let me ask you to play another role here. Let me ask you to be a strategic consultant to the United States, given what we as a nation should learn. Even as Lyndon Johnson had to rewrite his understanding of the world, 1967, what should we be thinking about right now?
Well, the first thing in wartime is, I'll quote General Douglas MacArthur to you. MacArthur said, "It is fatal to enter any war without the will to win it." Now, what troubles me, and your caller, Earl, really alluded to this as well, is the fact that, you know, we seem to start wars from Vietnam right to Iraq without recognizing what it takes to win, without being willing to win. And, you know, we all want to fight as morally as possible. We don't want wanton destruction. But we need to stand back and recognize that the greatest immorality is for the United States of America to allow itself to be defeated in any war, because when we are defeated, all of humankind loses.
Ralph Peters has already written 22 books on matters military. His newest, Wars of Blood and Faith, Conflicts That Will Shape the 21st Century, is to come out in August. Mr. Peters, what are you going to tell us in that book?
Well, I'm going to try to talk about why the world is as it is, what the real roots of conflict and hatred are, and what we can do about it, and what we can't do about it. So it's while I take a very optimistic view of America's future, despite, you know, justified criticisms, the United States, we're, barring acts of God, we're going to be even more successful in the 21st century than the 20th. But much of the rest of the world will be terribly troubled, and we need to look at why that's so in honest terms, not in bumper stickers and slogans and nonsense that makes us feel good. So I try to really look honestly in a nonpartisan way at the conflicts that we're going to find unavoidable in the coming years.
Well, once the book's out, I hope you'll come back on and talk about it with us.
I'd be honored.
All right. My guest today is Ralph Peters, and this is the kind of conversation that we need to have on an issue of historical consequence, looking back 40 years at the Six-Day War, in order that we can understand our own times. Folks, I'll be back in just a moment with some continued thoughts on this. And the topic now has to turn to how we as Christians should understand this. One of the interesting things that immediately happens among Christians is, of course, talk about prophecy. Is this the fulfillment of biblical prophecy? Should we look to the 1967 war in those terms? You know, as a Christian theologian, I always want to step back and say a lot of that remains to be seen. I think we have to be very careful to avoid presumptuousness. But when I come back, I'm going to tell you why I believe that the nation of Israel is a providential vessel for the preservation of the Jewish people in this age. Because we do know there is yet more to come to the biblical story. For instance, in the middle chapters of the book of Romans, we are told that there will be a vast outpouring of response to the gospel on the part of the Jewish people. When you look back to the end of World War II, one of the big questions is, how would the Jewish people survive? The nation of Israel is at least in part an answer to that question. More when we come right back. In Michael Beschloss's new book on presidential courage, my favorite chapter, and by the way, the entire book is a fascinating read, but my favorite chapter is the chapter on Harry Truman and the decision to recognize Israel in 1948. A lot behind that. One of the big questions at the end of World War II is, what is to be done? The knowledge of what had taken place at Auschwitz, Treblinka, Birkenau, what had taken place in the Holocaust, the assault, an attempted extermination of European Jewry, led to the recognition that something had to be done. And that something eventually took the form of the nation of Israel. Obviously a controversial topic from the very beginning. You're not talking about land that had been claimed by no one, but there's a lot going on in the back to that. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem had supported Hitler during World War II. There was an enormous sense of the rightness of establishing Israel. Of course, Israel had enemies in the very beginning. And Israel's survival as a nation was anything but assured. From the very beginning, there were those that sought to destroy her. 1967 becomes a pivotal year. After that, 1973. A lot going on there. And, of course, even now, Israel finds itself continually facing neighbors that want its extermination as a nation. There's a lot to be learned here. How should Christians think about this? Well, number one, it's a reminder to us that we've got to be very, very careful to be intelligent when we think about the controversies in the Middle East. It's very easy just to watch a couple of hours on television and think we're experts in the area. There are a lot of Christians who simply don't take the time to understand these issues, and that puts us all in danger. I would suggest that you need to be reading about this. And I would suggest to you, in understanding the Six-Day War, to read the book by Michael Oren entitled 6 Days of War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. I'd also encourage you to read some material that has a very different understanding of the war and of its importance. I think that will also help you to understand the issues that are at stake. A lot of the controversies we hear today about the war on terror or about anything else in terms of geopolitical issues comes back to the same question. Is anything worth fighting for? Is anything worth dying for? Is the use of force ever justified? If so, how? If so, when? In 1967, in my judgment, Israel had no choice but to fight. It faced extermination as a people and the fact that Israel will be eliminated as a nation. Israel has to live with the fact that there are still people, nations, forces that wish the same. And we need to be reminded, even as we observe Memorial Day just a few days ago, that freedom is never free. What should intelligent Christians think about the Middle East, about the Six-Day War and its legacy? I would suggest we need to be thankful that God preserved the Jewish people. And I'm thankful that God preserved the Jewish nation of Israel. God's not finished with Israel yet. One thing's for certain, Christians, of all people, must understand that. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Tomorrow we'll talk about what's on your mind. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.